The government reaction is one of anger and retaliation. That is exactly how Iran has reacted in terms of Iran's parliament. It has taken retaliatory measures like advancing its uranium enrichment for its civilian nuclear program, and also to start up its heavy water reactor, along with advancing its centrifuges. Now, unlike most countries in West Asia, the Iranian Foreign Ministry and the government have, however, disagreed on this matter. In this debate, we will discuss what those disagreements are and where that leaves Iran with the international community. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. We have Farhang Jahanpour, who's an academic and political analyst, who joins us from Oxford, UK. Also, Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, who joins us from Qom. I'd like to welcome you both. Sam Mahdi Torabi, let me first start with you. You know what has gone down in terms of, at this point, what the Majlis has done and where the Iranian government has disagreed with those steps. But if you can please lay out the groundwork for us and then, of course, add your introspective analysis to that.
Sure. First of all, let's be very clear that it is something completely normal in a vibrant constitutional state like the Islamic Republic is for the different independent branches of government to have difference of opinion. It has happened hundreds of times in the last 40 years. So I kind of disagree with the framing of the debate. It is the constitutional duty of the Majlis to be as an independent branch of government, to give its opinions, give its oversight. Oversight is part of the role of the Majlis under the Constitution of Iran, and it has done this. And it is also nothing new that the sitting administrations of the various administrations that we've had throughout the 40 years will disagree with many things that the Majlis does. The good thing about the Islamic Republic of Iran is, as I said, we have a constitution, we have rules, we have a thing called the National Supreme National Security Council, which is the place where all these debates are then brought together, all the branches of government, the executive, the legislative, judiciary, all the relevant pieces of the various parts of the government that we have, because it's not the government disagreeing, it's the administration disagreeing. The government is a larger is the larger establishment. It is debated and discussed in the National Security Council, and then the National Security Council makes a decision. And the final word on all these matters, on all these strategic matters, are, of course, with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. And so, as with all other cases, including the JCPOA itself and other things that happened, including the response that we had to the assassination of Haj Qasim, this will be discussed in the Supreme National Security Council with the final word by the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Okay, so please tell us, I don't want to say which side you're on, but tell us what you think about the steps taken by both, and in terms of the disagreement, and then who you agree with, perhaps.
Well, again, it's not about that. I disagree with the framing of the debate. The debate is that, for example, the Majlis has pointed out certain things that were in the JCPOA that Iran voluntarily decided to do, which is, for example, having the additional protocol, which is something that Iran did as a voluntary act. So, in its role, in its constitutional role, the Majlis is allowed to pass a resolution or pass a law saying that we will no longer implement the additional protocol. And the administration is free to disagree with that, or as the other things you mentioned, such as uranium enrichment, raising the level, or taking certain advances. By the way, let me just also add that all of these things are legal under the JCPOA. The JCPOA was not an agreement in which Iran gave any sort of promise to completely end everything. All the steps that Iran has taken since the non-implementation of the JCPOA by the Europeans and by when the Americans left, all of it has actually happened as part of the rules that govern the JCPOA. So again, it's not about this kind of thing that people, for example, maybe in the foreign media would like to point out, that there is some sort of a fundamental disagreement. We have a vibrant state, we have a vibrant political system, governments disagree, different administrations that come to power have different views. Parliaments, the majorities in parliaments changed. As we saw in the last parliamentary election, we had a different majority than we had in the previous parliament. So in my view, this is all a sign of the health and of the strength of our system. And when it comes to security matters, we have a very mature system in which security matters are determined by the Supreme National Security Council with the approval of the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Okay, so let me come to you now, Fahang Jahanpour. Just taking a look from the outside into what has happened, you're looking at one of the top scientists in the nuclear arena, also in the medical arena, because Fakhrizadeh was also aiding and cooperating in vaccine development for COVID-19. You have him being assassinated on Iranian soil in the form and manner that he has. And that's in a string of scientists that have been assassinated inside Iran. The natural reaction is for the parliamentarians, in this case in point, to come out in anger. And, you know, quite rightly so, again, from the outside looking in. And you're looking at an environment where you're also looking at a president, which may be outgoing at this point, who was mulling attacking Iran. The reaction in the form of some of the steps that they have taken and provisions that they have enacted, it may be a natural outcome of what has occurred. Do you think that they are right in introducing and passing some of the bills and provisions that they have?
Well, thank you very much for having me. First of all, there is no question about it that the assassination of a scientist in Iran, Mr. Fakhrizadeh, was an act of terrorism. And many people in the West, too, have condemned it as an act of terrorism, act of state terrorism. The question is how you react to something like that. Of course, as was mentioned by Mr. Turabi, there are always differences within any kind of government, East or West, and Iran is no exception. And it is the right of the parliament to challenge the government, to ask questions, to put forward different ideas, provided they do not impede the government from acting in the best interests of the country. I think, as I said before, the act has to be condemned and was an act of terrorism, but Iran should not fall into the trap of those who wish to make Iran take some provocative action, which would then justify further military action against Iran. I think Iran has shown in the past that it can act in a strategic, considered, measured way to these provocations, and I hope that they will do the same this time too.
Samah Titorabi, let's break down what the foreign ministry spokesman has said, Said Khatibzadeh, which is telling in some ways. Iranian parliament's efforts, which also included ending nuclear inspections, has met immediate opposition from the government. The government has explicitly announced that it does not agree with this plan, which it considers neither necessary nor useful.
Well, again, the place where Iran's national interest will be determined is the Supreme National Security Council. So the good thing about having a Supreme National Security Council is that neither the administration, whatever the sitting administration is, nor the Majlis has the final say in this. So yes, just as it is the right of the Majlis to have its views, and of course a lot of the members of Majlis that were voted this time around explicitly stated that they are coming because they want to change the course that the Rouhani administration has taken, a view that I share with these parliamentarians. I don't believe that you should have strategic negotiations with the West when you don't have strategic deterrence, such as missiles and such as having military power. After you have military power and you have strategic deterrence in the form of missiles and ICBMs, then you can sit and negotiate about whatever you want to negotiate about. I feel that there was a part of the elite in Iran which jumped the gun on this and was a bit too scared and didn't wait long enough to have for Iran to develop its... But that's not the issue. The issue is that even if the administration has this view or the parliament has this view, neither of which is the one that's authoritative in the end. It will go to the Supreme National Security Council. There it will be discussed in a process which involves all branches of government. It involves the military, it involves the intelligence agencies, and it, of course, involves the leadership. And whatever decision that Supreme National Security Council takes, whether it is to agree with the parliament in some of the things that it has done, or whether it is to agree with the administration, that's going to be the result. So again, this idea that somehow the administration or the foreign ministry in any way, shape, or form is the final authority on this is not the reality of the way that the constitutional system in Iran works.
Okay. There is a very important point here that is made from Saeed Khatibzadeh, the foreign ministry spokesperson, statements, Farhang Jahanpour, that I think if you can elaborate on us for us a little bit or give your thoughts on it, and that is the issue of Iran's nuclear policy. Obviously a very sensitive area. Iran has always backed and provided assistance, for example, the IAEA, when it comes to its Iranian, when it comes to its civilian nuclear program, and of course then it was negotiated in the JCPOA in terms of the provisions, etc. And the government has said that the move could not change Iran's nuclear policy. But at the same time, you're having the assassination to take place, and you're having this in addition to all the threats that the U.S. has always pretty much, in their famous words, all options are on the table, to have given Iran. And they are saying, under this lifting of sanctions umbrella, to fast-track this, within 2 months, have sanctions lifted. They're asking the Europeans that. So can you put these two issues into perspective for us?
Well, I think some people tend to forget where we were in the past and where we are at the moment. Before the JCPOA, Iran was under five Security Council resolutions imposing sanctions on Iran under Chapter 7, which means it was threatening international peace and security. Iran was isolated to the extent that even China and Russia, which claimed to be Iran's friends, joined in the sanctions against Iran. The JCPOA completely changed the situation. I was reading an interview between Mr. Biden and the CNN just a couple of months ago, and he said that before, when the JCPOA was passed, Iran became part of the international community. Europeans came on our side to agree. Russia and China came to our side to agree. But as a result of what Trump has done, we are now isolated, and Iran is increasing its nuclear activities. And he's absolutely right. America, especially Mr. Pompeo, tried to put a snapback through the Security Council. The result was completely embarrassing and shameful for America. The whole world unanimously took Iran's side, and America was isolated. Let's not forget these facts. The fact of the matter was, there is a difference between an Obama administration and a Trump administration, as we have seen. Trump withdrew illegally from the JCPOA and imposed crippling, unprecedented sanctions on Iran, and we can see the economic results of it. Mr. Biden is promising that he would return to the JCPOA if Iran also goes back to the full implementation. Iran, as you know, after the United States withdrew, waited for a year, but after a year, as Europeans could not change the situation, began to increase its enrichment above the levels allowed in the JCPOA. All that Mr. Biden is saying is that he would return to the JCPOA if Iran also returns to where it was prior to Trump withdrawing. I think that's a very fair solution, because we are not in a very strong position, neither are they in a very strong position. What Iran must not do is again to isolate herself in the international community and push the Europeans and eventually even Russia and China to America's side to isolate Iran. So I think the best thing would be that Iran, of course, has got many complaints, especially the assassination of Iranian scientists.
Exactly.
That's a separate matter. It must deal with it. It must, in fact, can do better deal with those if it has got friends in the West and in the United States. But it does not should not interfere with the JCPOA, which was an agreement between Iran and the whole international community, all the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, and also assisted by the Security Council Resolution 2231 and the European community. So I believe the best thing would be, maybe not directly, Mr. Biden has said that Iran should come back to full compliance before he can lift the sanctions. Iran says, the ball is in your court, you should lift the sanctions before we go back. I think these are semantics. What needs to be done, maybe through some sort of third-party mediation, is that we should go back to where we were before Trump illegally withdrew from the JCPOA. And then there are many, a host of other issues, many issues, that they have complaints against Iran, and Iran has complaints against America and the West. Then we can discuss those, as we were doing this after the passing of the JCPOA. So I think any rash action, and any action which is sort of, if you like, gives the impression of doing something, but in reality hurts the country, should be avoided. We must abide, and they have said, both Mr. Zarif and President Rouhani have said, that all these measures are reversible, and as Mr. Tarabi said, to some extent they were under supervision of the IAEA, and they can easily be reversed.
Okay.
So what Iran should do is that America should come back to full compliance, lift the sanctions, and Iran will also go back to the full compliance.
Okay, Sam Antitarabi, a couple things that our guests there said, I'm not too sure if you agree with or not. One of them, bring it back to you. And when he said Iran is in a somewhat weak position, and so is the other side, that's one of the things that he said. And the other thing I'd like to ask you, Sam Antitarabi, is the fact that this assassination needs to be used. I mean, blood was spilled, and our guest there says it's two separate matters. Iran's Majlis doesn't think that, and yet the government also has its own line.
The government doesn't even think that. I mean, the things that Dr. Jahanpour, with all due respect to him, and I respect him very much as a scholar, it sounds nice, but it is delusional. That's not the reality of what we had. What we heard from Dr. Jahanpour was not the history of what has happened, it's the mythology of what happened. The reality is that Iran did not have to necessarily negotiate the way it did. Nobody is against negotiations as a tool of statecraft. Everybody agrees. All states negotiate. There's no problem with that. The point is, out of what position do you negotiate? Yes, we were under UN sanctions, but we've always been under UN sanctions. And the fact that you had, at that time, go back to the time, at that time, when the whole process started, which, by the way, started in the Ahmadinejad government. It didn't start in the Rouhani government. It started in the Ahmadinejad government. With Dr. Salehi at that time, who was the foreign minister. So the point is that there were many indications at that time that the Russians, that the Chinese, that the Europeans were ready to break international sanctions because it was in their economic interest to do it, not because they cared so much whether the UN Security Council had made rules or not, because they don't. That's not something that's necessarily always the basis for their decision. There are hundreds of examples of where they don't care about the UN Security Council resolutions, and they do things because of their national interest. So it was in their national interest not to lose the emerging Iranian market. The Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians understood this. The Europeans and the Americans were scared that Iran was going to join the BRICS and become part of the BRICS strategic access in the emerging BRICS strategic access. So American elites decided that we're going to do something. We're going to smile. We're going to send some letters. We're going to try to accept Iran's right to nuclear enrichment, and that way we will get those elites in Iran who are pro-Western to put a final pressure on the system to go into this process. I don't deny that there were positive points about the JCPOA. It's not a black and white issue. The issue is, do you believe that Iran has to come to a strategic agreement with the West? My view is, and the view of a majority of the people in Iran, is that we went through this process, we had this experience. As the leader himself said, this will be an experience. So we went through this experience. In the last speech that he had, he said, we tried negotiating to lift the sanctions, and it didn't work. So this process is now complete. It has been tried and tested empirically on the ground. The Europeans and the Americans do not live up to agreements. So there's no point for us to try to go into another agreement again that's going to be broken by them. And by the way, let me just add another thing.
Quickly,
it was completely legal for Trump under American law to break, to end the JCPOA under American law, because it was an executive order. It never went to the Senate. It was never an international treaty according to American law.
Okay.
And this is one of the things that we told the government at that time.
Very
that
well.
Don't talk about it in this way, because the next president might change it. And at that time, this was said to Dr. Zarif, and Dr. Zarif, it was specifically said to Dr. Zarif, if Trump becomes president, he will rip it up. He just laughed it off.
I'm sorry, Samati Torabi. Thank you, Director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute. And thank you very much, Farhang Jahanpour. Wish we had more time. Academic and political analyst there from Oxford, UK. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, let me ask you a question of miscellaneous nature about prayer. If, you know, a person is hired to offer the prayers instead of other people, we know that this happens a lot, especially when the person is dead, and then the mourners, those people like the heirs of the deceased person, go to another mu'min and believer and offer some money to that specific person or individual to offer the prayers, right?
Sure. Yes.
Instead of on behalf of the deceased person.
Yes.
Well, especially when such a stipulation has been mentioned in the will, in the testament mm-hmm. of the deceased person. So can they ask that individual to offer those prayers?
That individual...
Like that individual ask another person
mm-hmm.
to offer the prayers.
The hired person, yes.
Ask another person.
Ask another person to...
Like he asks as a dealer.
Good.
Sort of.
Yes. It depends, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it depends on the person who has hired that individual.
Yes.
If he makes a deal or because it's a kind of transaction.
Yes.
Someone who hires someone else.
Yes.
He pays money and then...
As a proxy.
Yes, of course. And he as a proxy offers those prayers. Now, he has trusted that individual because you cannot hire any individual, any and every individual. According to Islamic Sharia, you have to hire someone who is trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's preferable to hire a scholar, a pious person, not an individual, because how can you make sure that he knows how to offer the prayers correctly? And how
he
can
knows
you
the tajweed, for example, the correct pronunciation,
the pronunciation, and also
intonation.
How can you trust that he will actually offer the qaza prayers?
Yes.
So it's always important that he hire someone who is trustworthy and preferably a scholar. Now, if he has not stipulated, if the heir has not stipulated that he alone should offer the qaza prayers, then of course he can hire another person and both of them, or maybe that third individual can offer the qaza prayers and there will be no problem according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. But if he has stipulated expressly that he himself and not a third person should offer the qaza prayers, then he cannot relegate this responsibility to another person.
Uh-huh. What if it's not been stipulated?
Yes.
No condition attached, but the heirs.
Yes.
The question is, with the permission of the heir, is it possible that that individual, that scholar who's been hired to offer the prayers, ask for the permission of the heirs to relegate it to another person?
Of course. It depends. Yes, it's absolutely permissible. There's no doubt about it. He can ask the heirs or the inheritors, or maybe the eldest son, because it's the responsibility of the eldest son, not the eldest child. The eldest son to offer the qadha of his father's prayers, okay, and also his mother's prayers, and he can allow, he can permit, and there's no problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
What about the situation where there is a seemingly supposed, let's say, sequence of qadha and kafara? If someone has to perform the qadha for something and then give kafara, should this sequence be observed? Like first the qadha and then the kafara, or it could be reversed also?
According to Ayatollah Khamenei, a observing sequence is not a condition.
Mm-hmm.
And a person can begin offering his qadha prayers first and then offer his daily prayers. And he can also start with his daily prayers and then offer the qadha prayers, and there is no problem. You use the term kafara. I don't know what actually it means. Kafara, there is no prayer as kafara, okay?
Yes.
We have qadha prayers, we have ihtiyat prayer which is offered as a measure of precaution, and we have the daily obligatory prayers, we have nawafil, the recommended prayers. These are the prayers that need to be offered. Of course, there are other mustahab, a lot of mustahab prayers are there, which you can find in Mafatih al-Janan.
Yes.
For example, nawafil, there are many nawafil prayers, including the night prayers. There are 11 rakas of which are offered in the middle of the night. We are not going to deal with those prayers, but when it comes to the obligatory prayers, like the daily prayers, they are obligatory. The qadha prayers, they are obligatory, but the time is extended. The time for the qadha prayers is extended, and as long as one is confident that he will be able to offer his prayers at any time, there is no problem in offering the prayers in any manner possible. Okay.
Yes.
Now, when it comes to the sequence, you know, there could be another scenario with regards to the sequence of the prayers which are offered. Now, some may say, okay, can I offer first the morning prayer and then the Maghrib prayer and then the afternoon prayer and then the noon prayer? Of course, there's no problem. You can offer the Maghrib prayer and then go to the morning prayer and then offer the Zuhr prayer and then the afternoon prayer. It's not necessary for you to observe the sequence, but it is important to make sure that you have performed all the prayers which
you missed
and which you were supposed to offer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for that. And another question is regarding wudu. We Muslims have to actually, wash different parts of a body before the prayers, and some people might think that when there is the time to or the call to prayer, they have to make wudu and offer their prayers. But what if somebody cannot, in fact, access, for example, water for, let's say, a while, and then he make sure that he does it like at home or wherever or whenever he has access to water, like a couple of hours before even the call to prayer, the yes. Azan time, okay? Sure. Is it permissible to do so? And then when there is the time or to prayer, to say the prayer, and he does it without making another wuzu then?
Of course. You know, according to Islamic Sharia, it's always recommended to be in the state of tahara, ritual
yes.
purity.
Yes.
And it's not necessary to have the intention or to form the intention that you are going to make wudu for the upcoming prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's not necessary. And of course, when the time has not yet arrived, the time has not set in, mm-hmm. you cannot make wudu for that prayer, because wudu becomes wajib when the time has already set in. The time when the time for prayer has set in, wudu becomes obligatory.
Yes.
And if the time has not set in, you cannot make wudu for that prayer. You are 2 hours are still left, and you want to make wudu for that prayer. This wudu is not wajib at this point, at this time, even though you know that you do not have access, you are not going to have access to water. But for the time being, it's not obligatory to make wudu. Yes.
As long as there is the intention, actually.
As long
right?
as the intention.
Yes.
Yes. But you know, according to Sharia, it is good, it's very recommended to be in a state of ritual purity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that intention to be in the state of purity, it's absolutely permissible to make wudu. And that is your intention, to be in the state of tahara, not to offer prayers, okay?
Yes.
And of course, if the time for prayer happens to arrive, then you can offer prayers with the same wudu. It's not necessary to renew your wudu.
Mm-hmm. So it's always logical, in fact, to intend for every action that you want to do before making the wudu, including the prayers.
That's something I think you need to explain it. Otherwise, maybe some of our people, the listeners, might misunderstand. They are prone to misunderstanding.
I see.
You know, you cannot make the niyyah for the prayer whose time has not yet arrived. You cannot make wudu for that prayer. That's what I'm trying to explain.
Okay. Thank you.
You can make wudu with the absolute niyyah of being in the state of tahara.
Right.
And it's recommended.
I see.
Yes. And if the time later arrives, the time for the prayer arrives, you can use the same wudu, the same ritual purity
exactly.
to offer that prayer.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
As part of Israel's land grabbing and illegal settlement expanding policies in the occupied West Bank, Israeli media have reported that a Knesset committee member and senior Likud member Nir Barkat has presented a plan to the Knesset to further expand settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and the Jordan Valley. According to the plan, Israel needs to establish some industrial zones and expand tourism in the areas.
Nir Barakat is one of the establishment, this fanatic Zionist establishment, that they are behind this colonial project. So what he did is not, he's saying and what he offer is not something new. It's part of the whole Zionist plan, colonial plan that's already going on the ground. When we talk this year about 15,000 housing units that has been issued, this is double than the last year.
Barkat has also announced that Israel aims to settle 2 million Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. This comes after contacts took place between settlers and Barkat himself over the past few days. Experts say to make this available, Barkat has put a plan to tighten Israel's grip on the Palestinian lands, adding that the Israeli regime will have to approve these plans before the inauguration of the next U.S. administration on 20 January 21 to make sure they will be applied.
Israeli parties are using the remaining period of Trump administration to carry out an ethnic cleansing project, first in Jerusalem al-Quds and then in the occupied West Bank. Tel Aviv wants to restrict Palestinians in their villages and at the same time to control their surrounding areas without official declaration of annexation.
During the four-year period of U.S. President Donald Trump, settlement activity has more than doubled as the number of plans approved by Netanyahu's regime increased 2.5 times compared to the previous 4 years. For years, Israeli authorities have continued to facilitate the expansion of illegal settlements in Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Mona Kandil in front of the Israeli settlement of Beit Il, occupied Ramallah.
The number of coronavirus infections is on the rise in Gaza. Infections have spiked to nearly 22,000 cases since March. Daily hospitalizations due to COVID-19 also continue to rise, bringing the average of serious and critical cases to more than 20% of confirmed cases. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at the increasing risk of contracting the virus amid a severely depleted healthcare system, which is largely attributable to the Israeli regime's ongoing blockade.
The growing number of infections is exerting a lot of pressure on our health system, which is already in a bad shape because of Israel's blockade. The health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and equipment to combat the deadly pandemic.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19 since March. People in Gaza who recovered from the deadly virus are still traumatized and say they are lucky to be alive.
The coronavirus infection was a horrifying experience. As a photojournalist, I have covered Israeli wars and military bombardments, and honestly, I was much more scared when I contracted the COVID-19 virus. When facing coronavirus, you are facing an unseen enemy. Anyone can get infected, and I have seen young people fighting for their lives in intensive care units.
The pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip and left a huge negative impact on the economy.
The pandemic started to spread locally in late August, and every day we hear of hundreds of new infections. The pandemic has hurt all businesses, especially small businesses like mine. I have to work every day. And if I don't work, I will not be able to provide food for my family.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices.
Experts warn that the unprecedented surge in COVID-19 cases in the Gaza Strip will soon overwhelm the under-equipped health sector. The tiny enclave has been under a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's incumbent parliament has taken by far the most headline-making measure since the beginning of its tenure. 251 out of 260 lawmakers voted yes to a draft bill dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions. The bill comprises nine articles, all authorizing the resumption of nuclear activities that have been limited under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The first and most important article requires the government to disregard the 3.67% cap that the deal has imposed on the grade of enriched uranium and resume enrichment at 20% purity level. The parliament's bill now needs the approval of the Guardian Council to become law.
My colleagues and I in parliament have tasked the government to suspend any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol within 2 months of the adoption of the law. The Islamic Republic will then continue to cooperate within the framework of the IAEA safeguard, but not the additional protocol. The government will also have to return to the 20% uranium enrichment grade needed to produce medicine for cancer patients. It will produce at least 120 kilograms of uranium with 20% enrichment annually at Fordo and stored inside the country. There are other steps all taken to revive our rights and respond to Europe's lack of commitment.
The new legislation was proposed in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Tel Aviv has long been openly trying to torpedo Iran's nuclear energy program. The Israeli regime was also implicated in the targeted killings of four other Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
The footprints of Israel cannot be cleared in this case. Mr. Fakhrizadeh has been the number one target of Mossad for two decades. And recently, there are reports that the weapon collected from the site of the Terrorist Act bears the logo and the specification of Israel military industry, and Israel has not commented on the issue yet, but it should brace for serious effort that from Iran.
Iran's change of tone toward the nuclear deal came in 2018, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the multilateral accord. Iran has also been criticizing the European parties to the deal for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. Last year, Tehran began a stepwise suspension of its nuclear obligations to make the EU keep its side of the bargain.
This last move by Parliament is the boldest countermeasure Iran has taken to, quote, keep the balance between its obligations and rights under the accord. They say this way they will unlock the shackles placed on the country's nuclear program and pursue the goals of assassinated nuclear scientists like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran, Cuba and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Qasem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations request and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaak is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they